We're about to explore an actual experience of the creative process in action. Here's the start of a short story published in the prestigious literary magazine Prairie Schooner by Daniel Wallace, and it's titled Father All Over Again. The narrator begins, "They talk, I listen. My face is as dumb, as still as rapture. I make all the right sounds listening. My oohs and ahs are carefully placed, but I don't believe a word of it. Not a word. These small town country people, they think they've got your number, think they know which end is up. They're a sly kind of people all around. So I don't. Didn't believe a word of what's said here. But I listen because the stories they tell concern me. The stories they tell about my house and the lake my house is near. They tell me about the catfish in the lake. You have to be the size of a full-grown man, one says. And the turtle, says another. Turtles will take your leg off if you swim too deep. Yeah, big, he says, stretching his arms farther than they will go. Your leg and more than that sometimes. I say, right, and they think they've got me going. Hear about the islands down there, son? About the islands at night? I've heard about the islands, how they rise and fall, how they might break the surface of the lake on just about any given night, rise and fall with a moon, like the tide, gone by morning. Strange. And as if this weren't enough, and it is, I never tell them it is, there are ghosts, too. Ghosts, that's right. Indian spirits whose graves were flooded when this lake was made. They come and go with the islands at night. There are three rules for living here, and it's taken me all this time, 6 weeks, to figure them out. The first rule, everything is seven times what it really is. Where I come from, there's a word for this, but here it's simply a way of seeing. Simply a way of seeing. So, keeping this rule in mind, ask me how hot it tends to get in the summer here. How hot? Hot! It gets so hot that the trees catch fire. The tallest ones do. The ones closest to the sun. Just like that. Snap fingers, fire. Think we're kidding? They've asked me. I suppose it's my eyes that give me away. See for yourself, they say, pointing to the uppermost leafless branches of an oak. Black, charred black. Black from the fire of the sun. Still, there must be something in my eyes. Something like that just doesn't happen, does it? How'd you think it got that way? Think about it. Say, lightning? Ha! Lightning, buddy boy, they tell me. The kind of lightning we get around here would split that tree into kindling. Which brings me to rule number two. Don't ask questions. Don't even think about it. Whatever it is, believe it and go about your business. The truth just gets stranger the more questions you ask, and everything they say is true. Everything they say is true. I can testify to that, because this morning I woke up, and there, not 100 yards from this shore, was a new island. It's not a very big island, no, but the fact is, it wasn't there yesterday, and it may not be there tomorrow if it rains real heavy tonight. Oh, the rains! I haven't told you about the rains yet, have I? Well, they say when it rains here, the clouds don't fall water, but rather drop and explode it, and that it comes down in great sheets like vertical tides from the sky, and then rivers form and flow right over the top of the lake, that cows, houses, and trees go with it, too. So good luck to you when the rains come, they say. My house, you see, would be the first thing to go. It's just where the rivers would be if the rains do come. So far, I've been lucky it hasn't rained once in 6 weeks. So, I saw this island coming. I've been keeping an eye on this lake. Without rain, the lake level dropped. And as it dropped, first by inches, then by feet, trees began to grow out there. 1, 10, 100 trees growing out of the top of the water. I didn't know what to think about this at first, but then I remembered. Smith Lake is man-made. Anything could be down there. There were trees, And as the trees grew, birds made nests in the branches, and the trees grew taller. Then, finally this morning, I saw land. And tonight, there's a fire and voices. From where I sit, I can just make out the figures. Spirits, I'd say. I've been drinking, but I believe it. What I see on this island in the lake are Indians, three of them, by the fire. It's a clear night. The sky is full of stars. Every night it's like this. Every night the sky is full of stars. It's remarkable. I was in town last week and said as much. I said I've never seen so many stars in my life. There aren't so many stars in the city, I said. And so they told me what stars are. I didn't know. This is what stars are. There's a star in the sky for every soul in heaven. When you die, and if you go to heaven, a new star is set just above the place you came from. And that's why there's so many stars here and not so many in the city. Everybody here goes to heaven. In that case, I said, I wonder where my father is. And they said, you'll know him when you see him. Or maybe they said, if you see him. Anyway, that's what I was doing on the dock when I first saw the spirits. I was on my back, on the dock, looking for my father. A word about this dock. It's a good dock as docks go, meaning it floats when it has to. But the lake is small now, and my poor dock rests on shore. It's a bed of wood that rests on solid ground, and it is a poor and pathetic thing. But it's mine. All of this, the dock and the shore too, is mine. It was in the will. A house and 5 acres on the point. Every bit of it mine, with the provision, isn't there always a provision, that I never sell it, but that I give it in turn to my own son when I die, too. I have no trouble with this provision, but neither do I have a son. The fact is, I don't even have a wife. What I have, all I have, is a house and 5 acres given to me by my dead father, which in turn is to be given to someone who doesn't and may never exist. If you can believe this, and you should, it's the law, then you can believe in catfish the size of a man, and that my father is up there somewhere, a star. I'm in town once a week for food, drive to the next county for gin. In town, everyone is an uncle or an aunt or some distant blood relation. They know me because they knew my father. They like to touch me. They like to show me things. He was a big fish, my father. It's how they put it. He was a big fish in a little pond. And that's good enough for some, but it wasn't for him. He wanted the big water, so he went away. And they say they can tell just by looking that I'm cut from the same cloth. They say I'm my father all over again. That's how they put it. Then they buy me coffee and ask me if I like it here, and they wonder how long I'll be staying. They say these things, and they never ask me what I do, how my days are spent down there by the lake. I'd tell them, but they never ask. The house hadn't been lived in for years, not since he stopped taking business friends down for fishing weekends, and it was in a bad way. The screens had fallen from the windows, and most of the panes were broken. Drunk teenagers with rocks? I don't know. But they were broken. And a vine of some kind had actually grown through one of the windows and wrapped itself around the kitchen faucet as though it were searching for water. There was a cup in the sink, a calendar from the year before I was born on the refrigerator. There was a long trail of ants that began just behind the couch in the living room and led all the way to one of the cabinets where something forgotten attracted them. A box of cereal, say, or can of flour, something like that. I opened the cabinet from a distance with a broom handle because no one was looking, and I didn't want to be close to whatever it was, even if it was something like that. In short, the place was full of everything a house is built to keep out, and I felt that if I hadn't come when I did, that it and the land around would have been taken in by everything around it. Unrecognizable as a place where a man had been, where a man had come with fishing buddies to waste a day or more. So if they were interested enough to ask, I'd tell them I cleaned the place up, made the place livable, planted a garden, etc., that it looks like a dream. But I'd be lying. Truth to tell, it doesn't look much better today than it did 6 weeks ago. I haven't done a lot to make it better, so I'm glad they don't ask. I don't want to lie to anyone. They're fine people, my father's people, but I can understand why he left this place. They like to wink. At first I thought it was a nervous tic with just a few people, but everybody does it. They'll say, "How you doing?" and wink. "Hot enough for you?" they'll say, and wink. "Have you caught anything yet?" they'll say, and wink their heads off. I don't get it, but I wink right back. I don't know what else to do. Highlights from a short story by Daniel Wallace titled Father All Over Again, published in Prairie Schooner in 1988. Now that date's a key for us. We want to shine a light on the creative process, and what we've just heard is a prime example of a creative artist at work. Daniel Wallace works out images and themes that have been filtering into his imagination and giving them shape in this short story. The story stands on its own, and yet, 10 years later, Wallace publishes a novel titled Big Fish. Wait, didn't we just hear that's the way the townsfolk in this story talk about the narrator's father as a big fish in a little pond? The story, we can tell already, is about the narrator and his father. And part of the framework that makes the story grab us is the tall tales of the townfolk and how the narrator rolls his eyes in disbelief. Catfish, the size of a grown man? Yeah, sure. But does the narrator actually hear voices and see figures on a so-called island? He admits he's been drinking. Ah, but there is a rational explanation for the island that appears in the lake when all is said and done. And the narrator doesn't want to be drawn into the whole tale-telling thing. If the townsfolk asked, he'd make up a story about all of the improvements he's made in the lake house his father left him. But then he's glad they don't ask, because he says, I don't want to lie to anyone. Truth and falsehoods. What is going on with all the exaggerations and the winking? Do the townsfolk really mean what they're saying? Should the listener read between the lines? Wink, wink. Daniel Wallace seems to be working through the germ of an idea that could be much bigger, grander. And he did, as we said, when he published his novel, Big Fish. That story and the way he told it was so compelling that it was made into a critically acclaimed movie directed by Tim Burton, and it even became a musical that made it to Broadway. What's fascinating is that Hamilton Gibson Productions in Wellsboro has chosen Big Fish the musical as part of its current season, a season which they're considering the creative process from many angles. Hamilton Gibson artistic director Thomas Putnam is directing the show, which opens in Mansfield this Thursday. And we had a chance to speak with him by phone about the show and why it's such a good fit as the ensemble's summer musical.
Our theme this year for the whole year is the transformative power of art. And so all of the things that we're doing and have done have explored that in some way, whether it is a comedy that we did this spring called Leading Ladies by Ken Ludwig, which has some elements of Shakespeare in it, but also just the art of helping people to laugh. So you can see that our theme is pretty broad, but all of the shows, all of the productions have something to do with the creative process and how that changes and enriches and empowers our lives.
Introduce us to Big Fish.
Big Fish is, I knew the movie from 20 years ago. Tim Burton directed it and So I remember seeing it, but I didn't know, I couldn't remember too much about it, except that it was a series of fantastic big fish stories. I mean, those kinds of stories that we exaggerate, and that, you know, if the fish is just 6 inches long in our storytelling, it is way bigger than that. And so, of course, that sounds a perfect vehicle for Tim Burton to get his hands on. But it's based on a novel. It was a first novel that Daniel Wallace wrote, and which is exactly the same thing, a series of fantastic stories about the character's father. And so when we were looking at musicals, we were looking for one that in some way explored the creative process, and perhaps the most basic creative process to humanity is the art of storytelling. And we've been doing it since time began, and they have changed lives. They have been passed for generations and years. And this just seemed to be something new. It's a musical that many people aren't aware of and aren't familiar with. So we always like to do some new things. And so coupled with that, with this wonderful expression of the power of storytelling, that's how we came to decide on it. Then when we heard the music for it, I said, yeah, this is one that we want to do this summer. It is wonderful music. The whole story takes place in Alabama, and so it has that down south and in some cases down and dirty kind of fun, funky music, folk music, banjo, guitar, but also some beautiful melodies. And the music by Andrew Lipa is it's really beautiful stuff. I don't know how better to describe it, but the cast that we have has really embraced it, and there's some wonderful ballads and great chorus numbers that we're really enjoying. Plus, many of them you just can't help but dance to. So we've had a number of different choreographers who have worked with us, and we did something new this year with the choreographers. We didn't have just one choreographer, because each story that Edward Bloom, the main character, tells comes to life on stage. And so when I first started reading the script, I said, yeah, this does better than even in a movie, because that's what theater is all about, is allowing the audience to imagine things. And so these stories, as he's telling them to his son, they suddenly come to life. And so the characters for each song, just about each song, is a story, rooted in a story. So we had a different choreographer for each one, because it's a little bit different. Each story is a little different. And each of the main characters in those stories are people that Edward Bloom has met, such as a giant, a witch, a mermaid, a circus ringmaster who just happens to be a werewolf. And so each of these stories have been told to Edward Bloom's son. And the son, who is now a young man himself and is ready to get married and begin a family himself, has tried to find out just what is the basis of all these stories. Why has his father been telling stories? And he doesn't know whether they're true or not. He knows that they're big fish stories. I mean, how many people actually meet a giant and a mermaid and a werewolf and a witch, as if they're ordinary people that he's met going down the road? So that relationship between the father and is kind of at the very heart of the whole show, the whole story. And it's a beautiful, beautiful exploration of father and son, with the son particularly just struggling to find out who his dad really is. And through the course of the musical, of the show, he discovers, and he is transformed by this realization and this understanding then of his dad.
As I understand it, the son is actually a journalist, so that he's in pursuit of the facts and the truth, right?
He is, yes. He is an investigative journalist, and he is marrying also a journalist. And so, yeah, his whole makeup is trying to find the truth and to get to the heart of a story. And he just hasn't been able to do that with his dad. So as we find out at the very beginning of the show, Edward Bloom is dying, and or discovers that he is dying. And So the sun is particularly, there's an urgency about really coming to find out just what makes his dad tick and why these stories. And Tim Burton, who directed the film, he is quoted as saying, "Big Fish is about what's real and what's fantastic, what's true and what's not true, what's partially true, and how, in the end, it's all true." And so that really is the essence of the whole thing.
And don't we sometimes hear fiction writers or critics, people talking about, well, sometimes fiction is truer than reality in the sense that those stories that Edward might be telling have an emotional truth to them?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's true about many of, let me say it this way, that a person could approach any religious stories with that understanding. And so that whether a story that has been passed down for centuries actually happened is not the point. It's that it is true. And so Will's wife, or soon-to-be wife, when she's just trying to help Will to understand, and at one point, when he says he just wants to know what's true, she says something like, "It doesn't really matter what's true. Your father is telling these stories for a reason. If you understand the stories, you'll understand the man." So there's a truth there, whether he actually met a giant who lived in a cave that's 7 feet tall or not. That's not the point. The point is, what's the truth in that story?
And he's a salesman too, isn't he? Does that have any resonance with the fact that Will is a journalist and Edward's a salesman?
Well, Edward is a salesman, a traveling salesman. So he traveled all over in the South, which meant that he was often absent from his child's growing up. And that smacks kind of hard to Will, that his father just wasn't there a lot of the time. But I think also just the fact that he is a salesman and he can sell things, I think has real parallels with just being able to tell a good story. And he can do both. He was successful at both. And everywhere he went, people loved Edward Bloom. There was just something about him that was charismatic, that he was curious, he was chatty, he was interested in just living life as fully as he possibly can. Early on in the story, he does, at least the story that he tells, is that he met a witch out in the swamp who could tell the future. And so he finds out how he is going to die. And we don't know what that is, but that gives him a freedom to explore all sorts of things that he perhaps never would have, because he knows, at least if he believes the witch, this person in the swamp, how he is going to die. And so there are times where the son questions him, you know, "Weren't you scared during the war where he saved the day and during some of these other escapades?" And he said, "No, because I knew that that wasn't how I was going to go," which is a really interesting thought. You know, would we live any differently if we knew how we're going to die?
And I don't mean to take us off the track.
Go ahead. I love to get up.
When we talk about a traveling salesman and his relationship with a son, we think maybe of the revival right now on Broadway of Death of a Salesman. It's a different thing,
but
it's a relationship of a father who tells stories to, or not the truth, to his son and that sort of thing. And it's a dark version of this, it sounds like.
Yeah, that it is really interesting that's found its way back now into this generation, and I'm so glad that it's on Broadway again and it's gotten such great reviews and the people are really embracing it. And Hamilton Gibson goes to the Stratford Festival in Ontario every fall, and they're doing a big production of Death of a Salesman as well. So it's I don't think the things that they happen by mistake. I think that there's something about that need to explore that kind of relationship of father and son that we're seeing these days. We're producing a play this fall called Red, which is a story of Mark Rothko, the painter, and a young assistant. Mark Rothko, of course, is actual character, actual person, but the play is a fictional account, and that this young man who becomes his intern is not a real person, but it is not a biological connection with an older man and a younger man, but it definitely has those overtones of this relationship of a father and a son and older man and younger man, and trying to get to the truth of just really what is this person all about, and what is true and what is not true, and what can I learn from this. And so it's interesting that actually we chose them, all the things for this season, and it was after we chose them, we said, boy, there is a real connection there between Big Fish and Red.
Let me ask you then, as director, Thomas, what have you found the most, well, I'm not saying the most, but what are some of the challenges, what are some of the delights of bringing this to life on stage?
As I said earlier, when I first started reading it and I came to the first story that it's the father and the son is ready to go to sleep, and so he's reading a bedtime story, and then the father says, you know, let me just tell you a story, not just read one of these stories that are in the book. So he begins telling about the witch, and as he is telling the story, the witch appears, and that story comes to life, and Edward Bloom then walks into the story. That happens throughout the whole musical. So I knew that many times in productions that I've seen, actually I've never seen an actual production of this. I've seen some clips on YouTube, and they use a lot of projection, you know, the whole screen up there, so the different scenes. But I said, we're really not capable of doing that, or at least I kind of shy away from doing projections because, I guess, maybe because I'm wary of things going wrong with them. And so the challenge was how to make this moving from his storytelling into the actual story and then back into him as storyteller and back and forth without stopping. And so once the lights come up in Act One, they never go off until the intermission. And everything flows with the use of lights and so forth. So the bed that is there at the beginning when he's telling the bedtime story to his son is there for that entire story down in the down left corner. And we watch the son watching the story come to life. And then there are a couple of times in that story where the father gets back to the son down stage left, and it all just moves so seamlessly, and it's just very fluid. And that was a huge challenge, and I love those kinds of challenges, how to make it theatrical. And that's what really got me jazzed about this particular one, because it is so theatrical, just because of that moving back and forth and imagination. And I mean, how do we create a swamp with very little, we have very little moving scenery. It's all done with lights and with costumes. And of course we had to have somebody who could play a giant. So we did. And we actually have a very tall man who's playing this giant, but he's also on stilts. So he's larger than life. But that was one of the huge delights, was the staging of it, the blocking and figuring out how one scene can fluidly move into the next without any break, because he's just telling stories right and left. The other thing is the music is so captivating, and some of the chorus scenes are, they're inspirational, and just in the way they're constructed, and there are a lot of themes, little musical themes that are tied from, you might hear it in a chorus piece, but then later on in Act Two, you might hear the mother or Edward's wife. It kind of comes in there as well. And so there's all these connections that perhaps the audience will not, or most of the audience won't actually connect and identify those connections, but they're there. And so whether people realize it or not, I think it's enriching and makes the whole work that much more exciting. And then there are some also beautiful ballads that are sung both by the wife and by the son that are just lovely, wonderful pieces. And that's been great to hear our actors really let loose with them and climb around in that music and really make it their own. It's been great.
Let's go back to the telling of stories as being so foundational to us as humans. And you say the musical is set in Alabama, and we sometimes think about people on their porches or at the rain barrel. They're out on the porch of the general store, wherever that might be, and it's entertainment, but it's also a way of building community.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In every, there are a number of chorus pieces, chorus numbers, and so those pieces, you know, I mean, we've got about 20 people in the chorus, and they almost always begin, the song or the scene begins with the people not at odds with each other, but there's some issue, some problem. And through the course of the song, which is part of the story, they are definitely brought together and connected. And yes, that sense of community is, it's just kind of the bedrock of the whole thing. It is, you're right, that storytelling builds community. And I think we have in some ways lost that in our culture, just the opportunity to take the time to listen to each other's stories, whether it is a small group of people, like you mentioned, just, you know, gathering around outside of a store or something, or to even though some of the big storytelling festivals that used to be so prominent around. We used to have we had storytellers from all over the place in Mansfield a number of years ago. And it was so wonderful for hundreds of people to come together and be united together there. But telling stories, I think, is the most effective and powerful way of communicating, more so than facts, more so than, you know, logically or logistics that try to prove a point. But if we can tell a story, that just appeals to where we are in our humanity.
You're going out to Mansfield, aren't you? Tell us where and when.
We are. We've been doing our summer musicals at Strawn Auditorium at the Commonwealth University in Mansfield. And it opens on Thursday the 9th and runs the 9th, 10th at 7:30. There are two performances on Saturday the 11th, one at 2:30 and one at 7:30. And then on Sunday the 12th, also at 2:30. Tickets can be bought right at the door. It's a big space, so we've got lots of room. Or they can go to hgp.booktix.com and order tickets online, either way. But it's a great hall. We've done a number of shows there. It was built back in the 30s, and so it just has a real charm and just wonderful history there. A number of our leads actually were graduates a number of years ago of Mansfield and were in shows when they were much younger. So that's been fun for them to be back on stage. And just want to mention Daffodils, just in case. That's all I'm going to say about it. But when I've asked people before whether they had seen this musical ever, this is way back when we were first considering it, and a number of them, they reduced it to a single word, daffodils. So I hope people can come and experience something wonderful with daffodils.
Artistic director of Hamilton Gibson Productions, Thomas Putnam, who directs the ensemble's summer musical, Big Fish. The production opens this Thursday, July 9th, and runs through the weekend at the Commonwealth University Mansfield, the Strawn Auditorium on the campus, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30 each evening, and there are two matinees, Saturday at 2:30 and Sunday at 2:30. That's Big Fish, presented by Hamilton Gibson Productions at the Commonwealth University Mansfield Strawn Auditorium, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So opening this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7:30, and matinees Saturday and Sunday at 2:30. For more information, on the web, hamiltongibson.org, hamiltongibson.org.